And welcome back to Coast. We've got 3 great hours just ahead for you with Linda Moulton Howe, a couple hours of some incredible stories. And then in our final hour, we call it Conversations with Linda, where we take your phone calls with her. And we will get into her reports in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, we'll have a series of incredible stories for you tonight. And, of course, capping it off with Conversations with Linda, where we take your phone calls, questions, maybe even your story tips. Linda, of course, is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, and author. She goes right to the people at the forefront of science and environmental challenges to get the stories that she gets. And when she goes after a story, she gets it, like the one we're going to talk about tonight, which is a startling loss of insect life in the Americas. This is a scary story, Linda.
It is, because the implications for the future are alarming to scientists. This started with a recent news headline from the School of Biological Sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. And the headline says it all. 2 degrees decimated Puerto Rico's insect population. And decimated means wiped out, destroyed. So what is killing all of those insects? Scientists think a lot of the damage is due to global warming. And here is one astonishing fact. The average temperature in northeastern Puerto Rico, the tropical forest there, since the 1970s has steadily climbed and is now 2 degrees Celsius warmer. That's a climb of 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, those sound like small numbers, but the fragile balance of nature on our planet lives within narrow temperature ranges. Biologists from Rensselaer decided to study insects in a place on Earth not much bothered by humans, and they chose the Luquillo Forest of northeastern Puerto Rico to see what was happening to the populations of winged insects called arthropods. Think of butterflies, dragonflies, grasshoppers, moths, spiders, and beetles, all of those kinds of creatures. Well, after a 2-year study, the findings were reported in the recent October 2018 proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by lead biologist Brad Lister, and he says, quote, "The insect populations in the Luquillo Forest of Puerto Rico are crashing. Our results suggest that the effects of climate warming in tropical forests may be even greater than anticipated," close quote. And the crash is a nearly 70% decline in the number of arthropods in that remote and not bothered by humanity part of the Puerto Rico tropical forest. And it's all happened in just the past 4 to 5 decades. Professor Lister warns that this severe decline in the Puerto Rico insects will be like dominoes falling for lizards, frogs, and birds who normally eat flying and other insects. Those amphibians and birds no longer have the abundant insect food supply they once had, and their numbers are declining as well. And it is not only Puerto Rico. It's happening from North America to Central and South America and across the globe to Germany, where flying insects there have declined 76%. It's as if the insects are now like the canary in the coal mine, sending us warnings that something is very wrong. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been warning of severe environmental threats to our entire planet if there is a 2 degrees Celsius elevation in average global temperature. Like some other tropical locations, the study area in the Luquillo Forest has already reached or exceeded a 2 degrees Celsius average rise in temperature. And the study warns that the consequences are potentially catastrophic. Upon reading this October Academy of Sciences report, I contacted Professor David Wagner in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. Here, now, from the university, is biologist David Wagner.
Professor Wagner, what was your reaction to the October 15th, 2018 insect abundance study of the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences?
Well, I thought it was the most alarming study that I've ever read. Up until now, we thought that the insect declines were localized in various places across the planet where there was very high human occupancy. So where the forests were being cut and destroyed and developed, where there are lots of roads, lots of light pollution, lots of pesticide use, lots of agriculture. This is well documented in Northern Europe, particularly Germany and England. We're starting to see declines in New England and North America. But what was most alarming about the Puerto Rican study was this was a reserve in the tropics. And if the insect decline was happening there too, we really had to ask ourselves whether or not this was a global phenomenon. Was this the clarion call that was going to rally us to pay more attention to what's going on with insects, collect more data, and try to find out what the causal factor is for these tremendous losses?
And when do you think there would be an answer to what is killing insects and how the whole world could be galvanized to try to help restore them?
We can't afford to wait any longer. So I think that there's going to be hundreds of labs across this country and thousands of labs across the world that are going to start paying attention. We have to find out where the decline is, the nature of the decline. For example, the PNAS paper points the finger at climate change and this 2-degree increase in temperatures. But some of the declines in Europe, they clearly started earlier. But I can tell you, probably within the year, there'll be hundreds, if not several hundred labs starting to look for answers. We have to find out what's causing this decline. It's urgent. It's important for the integrity of the planet. It's important for Mother Nature. It's important for what we put on our table to feed our children.
Is it fair to say that in the next 5 years, by 2024, we should know if these declines in insects around the world are persistent and maybe even becoming permanent?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think 5 years is a good timeline and 10 years even better. But I think in 5 years, we have to know. We can't wait. This is urgent and we will be collecting the data and we will have at least a lot more data points and more spatially extensive data. We'll be getting reports from Australia and Japan and China, Europe and the U.S. We have to figure this out. We have to get studies. We have to get data from the tropics as well as the temperate zone. And I can tell you, things are going to hell in a basket from Arctic areas around the planet. That's where we probably are seeing the fastest changes and some of the most serious. We need data from there, too.
Where it's melting so fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea that the insect populations would be declining at these kinds of rates if it kept on, this is dangerous for the future.
Absolutely. So the Entomological Society of America is on high alert right now. When you and I were kids and we took a trip, we'd have to stop every couple hours to clean the windshield of all the bugs. Yeah, that's what you stopped at gas stations for as much as for gas.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen anymore anywhere in North America or Europe. So that's the windshield effect. That was one of the first things that people pointed out as something has changed. This is not the same planet I was born on. There's a phenomenon here. There's something that needs to be explained.
Is there any data about temperature itself as it is warming that it will automatically begin to not only kill birds and those kinds of animals, but that insects themselves are going to become increasingly vulnerable to a rise in global average temperature?
Well, I think insects are cold-blooded. They heat up from, I don't know, 70 degrees to 100 degrees almost on a daily basis. So I think they have tremendous capacity for change. It will be a challenge for certain insects that are at their thermal limits, whether it would be in a desert or perhaps in these Arctic insects that aren't used to warmer temperatures. They may be driven to the brink of extinction or pushed over the edge. But I do think that things that are correlated with rising temperatures will be catastrophic for all wildlife. And I think about storm intensity. We all have been seeing hurricanes increase in intensity, and we have the highest recorded winds on the planet. These are more destructive. But more than that, I guess for insects, I'm predicting that it's actually the droughts that are associated with rising temperatures or even 2 and 3 degree increases in global average temperatures. It's the droughts that are going to cause massive problems and extinctions. These droughts are going to be of longer duration, they're going to be more intense, and they're going to be more frequent. And I don't think insects and many other animals, plants in particular, have the capacity to evolve different moisture physiology and to deal with these droughts. So that is going to be catastrophic. And then, as we saw in the American West this past summer, when we have droughts, we have fires. And there were times when it seemed like more than 100 fires were burning. Every Western state had more fires this summer. We're going to see more of that. And with that, we're going to see losses of our plant and wildlife and nature in general.
When would you see a signal that said to you, we have reached and are passing a tipping point of being able to actually live on the surface of the planet like we have in the past, if so many insects are dying out along with other animals and creatures that can't keep up with what is going to happen with global climate change?
I actually think that no matter what scenario, if we're talking about climate change, there will be winners and losers. Some of the species that are in the tropics now may be up in the temperate zone, maybe up in Connecticut and Colorado and what have you. So I think there'll be a great redistribution of species. It will be a very diminished fauna on our planet. It may not be as beautiful with wildflowers. There may be fewer birds. Much of the nature that we grew up with will be gone. I think extinction is the fate of all species, essentially. I think 99.99% of all species have gone extinct. What climate change does, especially now with this heating up, is changes the rate of loss. And we're losing species now as fast as we've ever lost in the entire history of the planet. So we're entering what we call the Anthropocene, or the sixth great extinction. And so there will be a great diminishment of kind, a variety of species. Some of the most dearly loved species, the iconic species, will be lost. But there's always something that survives. I hope it's not mosquitoes and cockroaches, but it might be mosquitoes and cockroaches. There'll be winners and losers, mostly losers.
Isn't there a serious threshold having to do with the pollinators? We have colony collapse and the problems with honeybees extending out to other kinds of pollinators. But if we are now looking through a lens from the PNAS report that insects are dying at huge rates unexpectedly around the whole world, what do we do about pollinators of crops that humans have been dependent upon for food?
We're going to have to maybe look for different sets of pollinators. Basically, the human portfolio is entirely dependent on the honeybee at this point in time, which is sort of ridiculous. We are so dependent on the honeybee. I mean, even to pollinate the almonds in California, I think when those trees are in flower, we have to put 80% of North American honeybees in trucks and truck them to California to pollinate. And so we're going to have to maybe start domesticating some bees or learning how we can use other wild bees to do some of these pollination services. I don't think we're talking about losing all pollinators. I think what we're talking about is losing many. And I know, for example, in Northern Europe, they've lost half of their bumblebees in many locations. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of our future if we don't stand up and start paying attention and find out what the cause is. How do we solve this mystery? I mean, it's basically a murder mystery that we have to figure out. We can't solve the problem until we understand what the cause is.
What is murdering so many insects?
It could be pesticides. The very pesticides that we need to protect our food could be killing the animals that we need to pollinate that food. You know, life's not simple. This is a hard problem of huge economic importance.
And how do you scientists find out who the murderer could be?
We have to look at pesticides. There's new systemic pesticides called neonics. I'm thinking that it's just sort of death by a thousand cuts, where it's the light pollution, it's all the roads, it's the land use changes, it's agricultural intensification, and all of these factors combined, which are ganging up on species and making it very hard for them to continue on their journey with it.
Professor Wagner, we're right at the end of 2018, and we're going to be entering the 2020 to 2030 decade soon. What is the worst case if scientists around the world working with political forces cannot understand or get some kind of control on the rapid decline of insects?
Worst case scenario is we have spring without songbirds. We have a planet diminished in all wildflowers. And so we have a very drab, boring nature. We start losing almost all of the small mammals and birds and bats, fish, reptiles, and amphibians that are dependent on insects. We start seeing the unraveling of ecosystems. We see less food available for people. We see carrion building up along roads. We have dung accumulating in our yards. It's not a pretty world. Nobody wants to live in it.
I like him.
Yeah, the sixth mass extinction. This time around, it isn't volcanoes. It isn't sheets of ice. It isn't a large asteroid. It's us humans terraforming the planet and changing the atmosphere and the oceans and the land. And at the end of November, the New York Times took on this subject in a feature entitled "The Insect Apocalypse is Here," and asked, what does a massive insect decline mean for the rest of life on Earth? And the author, Brooke Jarvis, wrote, quote, "What we're losing is not just the diversity part of biodiversity, but the bio part, life in sheer quantity." And he said, while I was writing this article, scientists learned that, one, the world's largest king penguin colony shrank by 88% in the last 35 years. More than 97%, this is almost 100% extinction, over 90% of bluefin tuna that once lived in the oceans are gone. A very interesting statistic that the number of toy giraffes sold in France in a single year is now 9 times the number of all giraffes that still live in Africa, and that a loss of even 30% of a species' abundance can be so destabilizing that other species start going fully numerically extinct, close quote. Well, we could ask ourselves, what does give a creature value, from a human to a dragonfly? And a lot of people say, well, it's the ones that have weight and territory. But maybe, George, it's the beauty and the grace and the vibrancy of a living soul, and that we can't lose that on this planet.
Maybe, Linda, that would be dramatic if we could do that and get this all straightened out. Does he say how much time we have?
Talking to Professor Wagner, who is a really down-to-earth scientist, I get the impression from him, and I have from other scientists, but I think he feels that by the 2030s to the 2040s, and that's not very long, that we're going to be having more and more violent weather, the extinction rates are going to be increasing, and that the only thing that might pull this back is what the United Nations has been trying to get the world to do now for 2 or 3 decades. And that is, if we could just cut back on the carbon dioxide and the methane and just hold a line so that we wouldn't exceed that 2 degrees Celsius, then it might help stabilize the planet. Otherwise, every scientist says we are up against what are called tipping points. And that's when whatever is changing in the atmosphere, the water, the land, the water has been absorbing a lot of this heat and things are dying because of that. And that there comes a point where the changes begin to accelerate past us being able to have any impact.
Faster and faster and faster. Up next, the secret astronaut. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Linda Moulton Howe with us, and we're talking about the secret astronaut. Now, in this series, there's a lot of setup and narration from Linda, so listen closely to the story. Linda, go ahead.
Thank you, George. Well, it was only a month ago in my November 29th Coast to Coast. I focused on 71-year-old Florida retiree John Harold Levine. On October 30th, that's only 2 months ago, he had posted a blog entitled, quote, "I've decided to come clean. During the period 1969 to 2008, I worked with NASA, CIA, NSA, and NRO. That's the National Reconnaissance Organization. My work with them involved both Apollo and Space Shuttle flights," close quote. In his blog, Levine claimed that he had been a secret astronaut on Apollo 17, the last official NASA mission, but was also on two more secret moon launches after that, Apollo 18 and 20. Levine said they were military reconnaissance missions, kept highly classified by the CIA and NASA so the public and media would not know about an alien presence on the moon that our government had been concerned about since the 1950s onward. In fact, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, in his important 1997 book, The Day After Roswell, revealed that as early as 1959, the Department of Defense was planning a secret Project Horizon to place a manned military outpost on the moon to deal with an alien presence. And they used those words. And for, quote, "defense of the lunar base against attack if required," close quote, and the implication was attack from the aliens that have a base on our moon. Now, following up on his October blog, John Levine sent me military records, his birth certificate, other documents, photographs, and Levine alleged his father was a close friend to aviation and aerospace tycoon Howard Hughes, who considered Levine a bright teenager and allegedly got him a job with the CIA before John graduated from high school. During Vietnam, Levine said he worked for the National Security Agency and was trained to be a pilot and eventually a secret astronaut. But after my November Coast broadcast, I asked retired U.S. Navy Captain Mark Wood to analyze Levine's military records. On December 6th, Captain Wood wrote me, quote, "Levine told you he flew advanced planes, including the TR-3B, but there is no record in John Levine's DD-214s of his ever having gone through any type of military flight training in the Navy or Air Force or Army. He was a radio tech in Vietnam for a unit that monitored Viet Cong low-power radio transmissions. And according to the DD-214, he never saw combat, he never left his base, but somehow he received an Air Force Commendation Medal Award. After leaving active duty, he went to the University of South Florida for a while, apparently to reenter the military via Navy Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, where he received a commission as a line officer and was assigned to a naval ship for 2 years. Levine has worn glasses for a long time, which should have been a problem in the 1970s in the military. There was no LASIK surgery, so you couldn't be a pilot. Even with contact lenses, you could not be a pilot. So how did Levine fly airplanes, let alone a TR-3B, as he claims, that would be more complicated and would require years of experience and to fly," close quote, Navy Captain Wood. Well, here are some other reality checks. Levine distributed a NASA photo that he said was him disguised with a fake nose for the secret 1976 Apollo 20 military launch. But researcher John Hacharian found the original NASA photograph in an archive about astronaut and geologist Catherine Sullivan. The year was 1989 when she, Sullivan, prepared for thermal vacuum tests of NASA STS-31 tools. So it wasn't Levine in that photo. Now, John Levine also insists that the secret Apollo 20 launch was in December 1976 on a Saturn V from Vandenberg Air Force Base, about 160 miles northwest of Los Angeles. Researching Saturn V history, there has never been a report of a loud Saturn V launch from Vandenberg that would shake the ground for 50 miles out. All Apollo Saturn V launches were from Kennedy Space Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then there is that photograph of a gray being that Levine claims he photographed with a high-resolution Hasselblad camera during the December 1972 Apollo 17 in the moon's Taurus Littrow Valley. The alien's big black shiny eye shows a reflection of a lunar module and what Levine calls an Earth set of our planet luring onto the moon's horizon. But Captain Wood says the lunar module reflection does not orient correctly and has to be an artist's illustration. Further, producers of the 2005 Xbox video game Area 51 say the gray alien photo came from their digital production. Other sources suggest, and this is very important to consider, that it is possible the CIA planted an actual gray alien close-up photograph in the video game world as counterintelligence, so the public and media would never take seriously any leak of a real photo of a gray alien on the moon. Not meaning that the one Levine used is real, but there could very well be one or more real photos that have been muddied by putting them out into the Xbox game and television world. Now, about Levine's claim of a low Earth setting on the horizon of the Taurus Littrow Valley, where Apollo 17 landed, NASA's historic Apollo 17 photographic archive shows Commander Eugene Cernan holding an American flag during the mission's first EVA on December 12, 1972, with a half Earth high above Cernan and not setting near the horizon. And the NASA photo credit is astronaut Harrison Schmitt. But there's a lot of argument about what exactly happens in what position in the moon in relationship to our Earth. It's becoming its own astronomical puzzle to solve. Now, Levine insisted that in December 1976, he traveled on a top-secret Apollo 20 investigation of a three-mile-long cigar-shaped UFO in a crater on the moon's far side that had been photographed 5 years earlier by Apollo 15 in August of 1971. It is a fact that NASA's Apollo 15 did photograph a long spindle or cigar-shaped object in a crater on the backside of the moon, and I'll have more about that in my fourth half hour tonight. Levine claims he and an astronaut named William Rutledge entered that ancient cigar-shaped UFO in the crater on the moon's dark side and found a dead and deteriorated gray alien and a strangely preserved female pilot on the flight deck of the huge UFO. When I first talked with Levine on the record about this bizarre story, he himself brought up the French YouTube producer Thierry Speth, who in April of 2007 began to release a series of web videos about a secret manned Apollo 20 on the far side of the moon. But Levine suggested that the CIA was behind the French YouTube releases as fiction in order to squash any retired NASA sources that might want to whistleblow about the real Apollo 20 investigation, which is exactly what Levine says he is doing now. Levine also complains about memory wipes to keep him from remembering his classified CIA and NASA missions, and I have heard this from other people who are whistleblowers. If Levine's memory was wiped, was it refilled with false memories? Beginning in 1953, 65 years ago, the CIA officially sanctioned mind control research called MKUltra. So is it possible that during the evolution of NASA's space programs, that the CIA was actively controlling leaks with MK-Ultra mind control? Is Levine's now 71-year-old mind incapable of telling the difference between implanted false memories and real truths from nearly 50 years ago, no matter how much contradictory evidence is presented to him? Another investigator who knows about forced amnesias and memory overlays in MKUltra has filed many Freedom of Information requests for MKUltra documents from the CIA. He is John Greenwald, creator of theblackvault.com. John's first FOIA requests to the CIA were as far back as 1996. He has received many documents, but persists in what he calls a battle with the CIA over still withheld MKUltra documents from the 1950s to the 1970s. It was in the mid-1970s that congressional hearings denounced MKUltra as a, quote, illegal program of experiments on human subjects by the CIA, close quote. One MKUltra document John has received is dated December 6, 1956, and describes what the CIA wanted. Quote, the production of amnesia, which could be regularly and successfully produced in humans through indirect, secret, or concealed induction methods that can include stimulations from mechanical, visual, auditory, drugs, chemicals, gases, aerosols, or hypnosis. Indirect, secret, or concealed induction methods. The induction of hypnosis by force, such as the carotid artery technique, or induction following shock or trauma, close quote. Here now, with more about MKUltra, is John Greenwald from his Black Vault office in Castaic, California.
John, when you go back to the 1977 Senate hearing, they called MKUltra the history of torture in the United States. And just to give the audience a sense of what kind of content we are talking about, it goes into how the CIA wants, quote, mechanical, visual, auditory, drugs, chemicals, gases, aerosols, and hypnotic control in order to produce amnesia and any other behavioral modification that they want, close quote.
The MK Ultra program were doing really dark, sinister things. There are additional documents in addition to the one that you just read from where it shows exactly what they were going for. What's scary is that there are other project names that are completely redacted. So the project names themselves are still classified. Even though that we've had the congressional hearings and the testimony in those hearings, MK Naomi, MK Delta, MK Ultra, all these various program names that have come out over the years, these documents prove there's more. And what's also interesting about the documents that redact the project names is that the objectives of those research programs are also, in some cases, entirely redacted and classified. What in the world could be worse than what you just read? And so there is some really dark stuff here, and it is not in the public domain. So I think a lot of these documents, they have never seen the light of day before. It's pretty mind-blowing. We know at the time that the CIA was creating front companies that were working with some universities and pharmaceutical companies and so on in order to achieve the objectives of MKUltra. The funding, however, a lot of that was destroyed, meaning the actual paper trail to figure out where some of this money came from and where it went. They would get people, they had no idea that they were going to be subjected to LSD and hypnosis and weird experiments. They would go to bars and they would pick up women, bring them back to these CIA safe houses / hotel rooms, and they would have a two-way mirror and they would start to see how they could ultimately extract information from people just off the street. No medical pre-screening, no nothing. And when you look at some of the financial records that did survive, it's a fairly creepy thing to start thinking about what they were really doing and what type of experiments they were really undertaking. And now I'm seeing all of these new documents, or at least some of them are new in the sense they've never been out. So it's making me realize that there's probably a lot more that survived, but the CIA is actively covering this up.
And think about this, George, 65-year-old documents are still being covered up. Now, CIA Director Alan Dulles, on April 13, 1953, and the MKUltra was sanctioned by him in 1953.
And he was the one that Kennedy dumped when he came in into office.
And that we, Bob Wood, I, and a bunch of us think that Dulles stayed on as the MJ-1, the head of the MJ-12, and that his definition of national security, having to do with the whole alien scene, trumped, and I'm using that word in the old original, where you
like a card.
Yes, like a trumping a card of JFK, and that the president of the United States had to be taken out when he wanted to have the Soviets join us on the moon. And that was a national security threat to MJ-12. Well, so we're now talking about the same guy. In 1953, the MK-Ultra, George, was not a project. It was 162 different secret projects.
Yes, it was huge.
Yes, and it was covertly financed by the CIA in contracts that went to universities, research foundations, at least 80 institutions, 185 researchers, and many of those researchers, they were getting money, and they didn't know it was coming from the CIA. And I found that the CIA had provided funds to a private research foundation operated by a Charles Geschichter. He was a doctor, which in turn used the money to make a research building at the Georgetown Medical Center, which had a lot of prestige. And in 1977, when there were the congressional hearings in Washington about MKUltra, Dr. Geschichter testified before the Senate committee that over a period of 13 years up to 1967, so going from MKUltra starting, his foundation alone had funded over $1 million, we're talking 50s, 60s money, of research at Georgetown and $2 million of research at other universities. The Georgetown research related to drugs to produce amnesia. This is critical to this question. Can you block the memory of somebody that you want to control? And they are doing work for you, and you're putting them in dangerous assignments.
Like Sirhan Sirhan, they say. Linda, we'll come back with more of this as we continue with this story on Coast to Coast AM.